This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The Hurricanes will not fight the punishment handed down this week by the NCAA for violations in its football and men's basketball programs. After more than a two-year investigation, a flawed investigation, as it turns out, the University of Miami gets 3 years probation and loses some athletic scholarships, but no postseason football ban. UM President Donna Shalala.
For the NCAA report to put controls in place, and we basically eliminated almost all contact between student athletes and supporters of the program. Everybody works for compliance. No matter what your job is at the athletic department or at the university, everybody is responsible.
On campus this week in Coral Gables, the student reaction, well, after a two-plus-year investigation, really more of a shrug than surrender.
Finally. I was a freshman when that all came out, so I've been through it all while being here. I think overall, that seems pretty light.
That's the best part. I mean, I'm upset that there's going to be scholarships lost, but whatever. I mean, obviously they had to do something. It's a pretty big issue. We did something wrong. We should be penalized for it, but I don't think it was as severe as it could have been.
UM students Tyler Goodman and Joshua Gruber there. Did UM get what it deserved? Did it get off easy in this fundraising scandal involving just one booster? Are you a UM alum? Has the episode changed whether or not you donate to the school? How about college student athletes? Tell it what your experience has been like playing college athletics. 800-743-WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. 1-800-743-9576. Email us at theflorida.roundup@wlrnnews.org or on Twitter at WLRN. Michelle Kaufman from the Miami Herald joins us. Billy Corbin from Rock on Tour Films also along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Michelle, first of all, give us an idea of the lead up to this week's decision finally by the NCAA to essentially accept what UM has already punished itself for.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened this week is it was kind of anticlimactic in a way that UM has already punished itself quite a bit. When people say no bowl ban, they actually had two bowl bans. They banned themselves from two bowls and banned themselves from essentially their first ACC championship game. So they definitely punished themselves. They restricted a lot of things with visiting and with recruiting. They suspended eight football players for multiple games. They suspended three basketball players for multiple games. So the university really was very, very proactive in this. And I think that that's what made the big difference. And people around the country may say they got off light, but they've been recruiting under a cloud for almost 3 years now. And Al Golden and Jim Larranaga have had a lot of trouble when they walk into living rooms and the parents say, well, what about this Nevin Shapiro thing, you know? And the other schools recruiting against them were using that to recruit against them, saying, why are you going to send your kid there? You don't even know what's going to happen. They could be suspended. So I think that the university suffered a lot over the last few years, and the punishment that they got is probably just about what they deserved.
Billy Corbin, you know the swagger of the U back in the 80s and 90s. Did the punishment fit the crime in this case, in your opinion?
I think the sanctions were ultimately not unfair, but they were unfortunate. I'm speaking of not the quantity so much as the quality, the content, and who it was that was punished. Very rarely do people speak for the student athletes and the assistant coaches who are often scapegoated in incidents like this. When you look at it, the NCAA did find that there was lack of institutional control. That wasn't because of a few rogue employees in the athletic department who are running amok. That's because, as evidenced by the testimony from some of the players that we've heard reported, they were introduced to Nevin Shapiro not from assistant coaches, but from people in the administration. And so when you look at it, now you have nine football scholarships, three scholarships in basketball. Those are kids in high school and middle school who are not going to get an opportunity to get an education at the University of Miami, to wear the U, which might have been their lifelong dream, because there are that fewer scholarships available. But what did happen is they deprived the student athletes the opportunity to play in postseason games for 2 years. But yet the university still collected their share of the ACC TV bowl money revenue. So wouldn't it be more fair, let's say, to hold the people accountable who were accountable, the administration, and fine them that money rather than deprive innocent students an opportunity in education?
Michelle, speak to those two points. I mean, the first one being it's the future student athletes, in Billy Corbin's opinion, who are being punished here. And the second is that the lack of a postseason appearance on the part of the Miami Hurricanes back in 2011 and 2012 was self-imposed. That was not an NC2A punishment. That was something the university put upon itself in anticipation of this NC2A investigation finally wrapping up, perhaps costing some publicity on the part of the Hurricanes not playing in the postseason, but certainly not a significant financial cost because you're still able to share in the proceeds for the entire conference.
Right. Yeah, I do think that the people that get punished are the wrong people in general. I mean, all the student athletes who are there right now in the football and the basketball program, none of them had anything to do with it. And some of the guys who played at UM the last couple years in football did not get a chance to play in a bowl, even though they had absolutely zero to do with this. Every coach who was involved in this has left the university. And even some of the coaches who have left, the assistant coaches, the little guy is always the one who, you know, the little guy gets the hammer. And the big guys, the institution lives on and will play on. And Frank Haith, he's the head coach. He's off at Missouri making $2 million a year. He'll sit out five games, but by November 28th, he's going to be back on the court. But the assistant coaches like George Fernandez and Aubrey Hill, these guys that were just loyal employees and assistants who they did make a judgment error. They made a mistake. They've admitted it. But their lives have been really wrecked for the last couple of years and will continue to be for a while. And so I do agree that the wrong people are punished. And then you have administrators like, I don't know, Kirby Hocutt. I'm not sure how his name is just invisible. He was the athletic director when many of these things were supposedly happening. And he kind of, you know, left town, went to another school, and he wasn't even mentioned in this report. And from what I understand, he and some of the members of his fundraising staff were the ones who introduced Nevin Shapiro to some of the coaches mm-hmm. who did end up getting in trouble. So I do think that the punishment goes to the wrong people.
Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald, Billy Corbin with Rock on Tour Films. Billy, why, if you're not a UM fan, a UN alum, a UN student, a UM parent, why does any of it matter?
Well, ultimately, it matters because I think what this exposed was a dysfunction and a fundamental corruption in academia, its relationship to athleticism, the unjustness of the NCAA, which as long as it was able to be this mysterious, shady organization in Indianapolis that no one really understood or knew who it was or what it really did, they were able to get away with a lot more. Now in this era when even the major spy organization of the country can't keep secrets anymore, it's tough to exist in a world with transparency like that. And now that you can go online and download a PDF with the bylaws of the NCAA, which are absolutely arcane. They don't take into consideration the average lifestyle of a college student, let alone a specialized student right. like a student athlete who, if you saw him, if you're a booster of the university or an assistant coach or work in the athletic department or even on staff at the university, and you see a student athlete sitting in the rain waiting for a hurricane shuttle on campus, you actually can't give them a ride home. That would be an impermissible benefit. So the craziness is now kind of outed. And the great irony of the University of Miami, which used to be the great national villains of college football and college sports, where not once but twice in the last 15 years, Sports Illustrated has said we should get rid of football at University of Miami. Now you've kind of seen the sports fans and the sports media, if not galvanized behind the University of Miami per se, at least the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and certainly against the NCAA and this unjust system.
And in this case, the unjust system is the system of student athletes with Division I top-notch athletic programs. And Michelle, as you know, most of those Division I athletic programs are money losers for school. It's only very few of them. It's a percent of a percent that actually are cash flow positive. But the kinds of cash flow that those kinds of programs generate for those schools can be in the millions of dollars. And is this instance between the NC2A and UM fundraising yet just another crack to show how flawed this college student athlete system that we have in the United States is?
Yeah, I think the whole system is flawed. And you are right that a lot of the programs don't make any money. And most of the sports don't make money. Even a lot of the football teams don't make money because the football team costs a lot of money. When you're traveling with 85 players and a staff of dozens of coaches and trainers and everything that goes into a college football program, it's very, very expensive to maintain all the equipment, all the practices, everything they do. So it's very expensive, and it is very difficult for them to make money. And yet, you know, the TV contracts are so huge, and there is so much money involved. And really, that's what leads to, in some of the people that I've talked to during this, the last few days, and people who were involved, the big money, and the big money that's at stake is what kind of leads the, it's what leads people to make judgment errors like these coaches sometimes make, because the pressure to get the top recruit is so huge because the stakes are so high. And that's why they, you know, they're going to go out there and do what they can to get the recruits, and the rules are ridiculous. A lot of the rules really truly are ridiculous.
This is the real dichotomy here though, Billy, between so few of these Division I or Division II or Division III college athletic programs actually generate money. Most of them cost money. That cost can be embedded not only in student fees and tuition and other kinds of situations that us mere mortals simply pay to enjoy a college education on these campuses, but then you also get the fueling of higher and higher college coaching salaries, certainly into this, and the student athlete is left in the lurch.
Yeah, free enterprise seems to only come into play when it comes to the coaches' salaries, for example.
Free enterprise is not free.
But now we have an issue where I think the pendulum is starting to swing towards the labor. It took long enough, but look at Grambling. Here's an institution where the student athletes said, we're dissatisfied with the conditions under which we have to work here.
Right.
And the NCAA's worst nightmare was realized the student athletes had a walkout.
Stopped working.
They
the football team stopped playing.
A game. Can you imagine if that happened to one BCS game, the amount of money, the revenue that would be lost? I mean, that is, I know it started Grambling. It's a low level institution, but that just shows that we're at that point. And the enduring image of this whole scandal, so
by low level institution, you mean it's not a Division I.
Exactly.
It's still a high quality education.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in terms
right.
of the football program
exactly.
and its reputation, its performance, but the enduring image of this entire so-called scandal. And remember, when this all started in August of 2011, people were saying this is the worst football scandal in history. I think the bar has been raised subsequently by other more horrendous college football related scandals and what universities have done to preserve their football programs. But the enduring image here is not show causes for these assistant coaches, but the image of Donna Shalala accepting that check at the Lucky Strike bowling alley in South Beach with Frank Haith, Sebastian the Ibis, and Nevin Shapiro holding the mic. He had just handed her that check. She is glaring at it like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, salivating practically on it. And what she does is she takes that check with one hand, and with the other hand, she wags her finger in the face of student athletes and says, do as I say, not as I do. And you just, that a system like that is destined for collapse.
Billy Corbin from Rock on Tour Films, Michelle Kaufman from the Miami Herald. My name is Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. April joins us from Miami. April, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What can we do for you?
I am actually a UM alumni, and I graduated in 2009. So I was already out of school by the time all this kind of heated up, but I find it interesting now seeing all this, that as an alumni who's still very connected to the university, kind of going off Billy's comment, I can't even deal with student athletes. I can't offer them rides, like he mentioned, things like that, because we're so afraid of the NCAA coming around. And I just think it kind of takes away from the U family and the whole situation that we try and raise at the school. And now that this is finally over, I hope that more alumni donate now and realize that we're past all of this and we can now move forward and go back to being as great as we were.
And in fact, we were talking with the president of UM, Donna Shalala, earlier this week here on WLRN. And Michelle, I know you spoke with her as well. And she said they've had some of the best fundraising seasons ever since this scandal broke. Hasn't impacted the flow or the velocity or the size of donations whatsoever.
Now, I think UM has always, I was at UM in the mid-80s. I was there from 83 to 87. And I think Miami has always had sort of the us versus the world mentality. I think it's kind of a Miami thing in general. You know, the rest of the country kind of looks down here at the bottom of this peninsula and whatever. They make fun of us. They don't understand us. And people down here get really defensive. And I think UM is a perfect personification of that. I feel that same attitude of like, hey, we know what really goes on here. We know that it's a small private school. There are good people there. There are good people who work there. There are good people who play sports there. And we are not you know, this is what the alumni think. We are not the national villain that everyone thinks. I just think it's too easy in the national media to paint people as good guys and bad guys, and, you know, like they did Catholics versus convicts back in the day. And that's just always been the image of UM. And I think the people at UM get really defensive and kind of, I think everyone kind of rallies together when something like this happens. And I think that did happen with this Nevin Shapiro scandal. I think UM people sort of bonded over it.
Well, in terms of the characterization of UM, Billy knows this well. Every good conflict needs good drama, and that means you need good characters. And there's certainly plenty of them here in South Florida. This is the Florida Roundup. That was Michelle Kaufman from the Miami Herald. Billy Corbin with Rock on Tour Films. Thank you to both of you. Still to come, have you ever found out your doctor has some complaints only to discover about those complaints later? Have you filed a complaint against a medical professional? Be sure to join that conversation. Coming up, how the state has delayed taking action on complaints about doctors and nurses. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It's now been 3.5 weeks since open enrollment began on healthcare.gov. That's the federally run state health insurance exchange as part of the Affordable Care Act. And this week, Florida Blue, the largest health insurer in the state, notified 300,000 people their insurance plans would not be offered next year. Now, when the law was signed, President Obama spoke frequently about people being able to keep their insurance if they wanted to.
If you like your current insurance, you will keep your current insurance. No government takeover. Nobody's changing what you've got if you're happy with it.
My name is Steve Briner. My policy was canceled effective December 31st. I had AARP, United Health Advantage Plan, and they just sent a notice in the mail that my policy would no longer be in effect.
Reiner is among those having to find a new policy after some insurance companies decided to allow certain policies to expire at the end of the calendar year. We will hear from Florida Blue coming up in just a moment here on the Florida Roundup. We do want to hear from you as well. Are you affected by this? Have you been successful at healthcare.gov to sign up or at least shop for a health insurance? Join that conversation ongoing right now online at WLRN.org. Tweet us at WLRN or call us 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Daniel Chang covers healthcare for the Miami Herald, and Eric Barton, Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, also covering health issues here in South Florida along with us. Daniel, first of all, were we anticipating this kind of policy expiration when the individual mandate comes in full force at the beginning of 2014?
Well, I think some of us were anticipating it, and clearly many people weren't, but they probably should have been, because the law clearly states that beginning in 2014, you need to have a qualified health plan. And generally, those plans offer what are called 10 essential health benefits that can include hospitalization, emergency room visits, prescription drugs. Many people were happy with basic plans that may have cost them very little, monthly premiums, had high deductibles, but covered them in catastrophic events and may have covered their annual well visits. And now suddenly they have to have a plan that may cost them $250 a month and covers much more. If it's not what they want, they're not going
to
be happy.
And to be clear, the policies aren't being canceled. In other words, they're not being canceled right now. They're essentially expiring after the policy term ends at the end of the calendar year.
That's right, Tom. And Florida Blue, which is the largest insurer in Florida, they in the individual market anyway. That's what they've said as well.
Jason Altmaier is with Florida Blue. He's a senior vice president of public policy and a former U.S. representative from the Keystone State of Pennsylvania. Former Representative Altmaier, welcome to the Florida Roundup. You represent Florida Blue now. Why did it undertake this action affecting 300,000 policyholders?
Florida Blue is trying to be proactive for our policyholders. There are 300,000 of our individual policyholders who have plans that do not meet the requirements under the law once it's enacted. And as your guest just said, there are 10 minimum benefits that are required every plan must have. So we are proactively sending notice to all of them that if they do nothing, we will move them into a plan that we expect would be as similar to the plan that they have within the specter of the law that we can possibly do. But if they want to talk about their options, we encourage them to get in touch with Florida Blue, visit one of our retail centers, communicate with us on the phone or online, and we'll try to walk through them what their options are. But we want to keep these 300,000 people as Florida Blue members. We're going to do everything we can to give them a plan that fits their needs, and we want to help them through the process.
Jason, was there an option for Florida Blue to continue some of these policies outside of healthcare.gov?
There was no option to continue those policies as they are currently written because they did not meet the requirements of the upgraded qualified health plan that is required under the new law. So these are people that we sent notices to saying, this is what we're required to do. We're going to help you through the process of change, and we want to keep you as members of Florida Blue.
So the sense from Florida Blue is this is a direct result of the legislation of the Affordable Care Act.
It is. That doesn't mean it's a negative result, because a lot of these people are going to have plans that are upgraded from what they currently have. They're going to have more generous benefits, and a very large number of them are going to qualify for federal subsidies. So in some cases, their out-of-pocket costs are actually going to be less
right.
for a more generous health care plan.
They could get more coverage at a lower premium under this plan. Jason, you were on Capitol Hill during the debate for the Affordable Care Act as a representative from Pennsylvania. You're now the Senior Vice President of Public Policy for Florida Blue. You heard the president quite often back in the spring of 2010 when he signed this bill into law, talking about how Americans could keep their insurance if they liked it. Make that connection between the statement then and the reality now.
I think it's fair to say the president probably wishes he had not said that, and that was a staple of some of the statements that were made as the bill was in the drafting process. Once the bill was signed into law, this provision was clear to everybody, so I don't think following the law's enactment that anyone was saying that, because everybody knew as of January 1st, 2014, healthcare plans would have to meet this new increased benefit package, and a lot of the plans in the country didn't. So it doesn't mean they're going to be dropped. They shouldn't lose coverage, but people are going to have to change to a different plan that'll have higher benefit levels.
Now, I know that Florida Blue certainly is not responsible for healthcare.gov and some of the technological problems that that website continues to suffer from. But Jason, can you give us an idea of signups that Florida Blue has experienced since open enrollment began 3.5 weeks ago?
There have been a lot of technical issues. It's been widely reported. It's no secret. We, of course, get signups not just through the exchange, which is a federal exchange in Florida, but we get people who change their coverage over time and people who enroll in different ways. So we don't have a number of people who have enrolled solely through the exchange, but we are getting new members. We're seeing increased enrollment numbers throughout the year, and we're hopeful that when we get this glitch resolved at the federal level, that we're going to be able to quantify what that level of coverage is, not just in Florida, but all across the country.
Jason Altmaier with Florida Blue, Senior Vice President of Public Policy, former U.S. Representative from the state of Pennsylvania. Thank you for that information. Daniel Chang with the Miami Herald and Eric Barton from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Eric, just curious from your perspective here, as we're 3.5 weeks into this open enrollment, you're looking at some of the professional licensing issues we'll talk about here in a moment. But what strikes you about this insurance debate here as we're moving toward this individual mandate very, very quickly, still having lots of trouble, lots of concerns, lots of questions about who can do what under the law?
Well, it does seem like there is a lot of surprises. I mean, obviously, first the website not working right, and now this where people are getting their insurance dropped. We should mention that there are 14 million Americans that could be affected by this. And the real fear is that they get dropped on December 31st, can't get onto the website to sign up before they can basically lose their coverage and get Obamacare to help them. And so you do have to wonder what other surprises we have down the road.
And to that point, Daniel, didn't we hear from the administration giving a bit more headroom coming up in the springtime in regards to signing up?
That's correct. They've extended the deadline to March 31st. Previously, it was really February 15th by when you had to buy a policy that would begin to take effect on March 1st. They've extended that deadline for no penalties now to March 31st.
A six-week extension here as we're moving close. Jason joins us here on the Florida Roundup from Miami. Jason, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually a small business owner. I own a consulting firm. I actually help medical centers implement the exchanges. And I myself had to sign up through the exchanges for health insurance coverage because as a small business owner, I didn't have coverage. So I was able to successfully enroll. One thing I would like to say regarding this idea of people having to change insurances it's really the fault of the insurance companies for not providing adequate coverage. I mean, these 10 essential benefits that are covered under the law should have already been provided. So I think one thing that's important to point out is that these folks are going to be getting better coverage. And as your Florida Blue representative said, they're actually going to be switched into a comparable plan. It's not like their plan is just going to be canceled and all of a sudden they have no insurance.
Well, this is a clear indication, obviously, of the impact of this law, Jason. As you mentioned, these 10 essential benefits mandated by this. Prior to it, there were no essential benefits, Daniel, that an insurance, health insurance policy had to cover in order for it to be sold into the marketplace.
There were not, Tom, and that's an interesting point of view because many people liked having a choice.
Right.
And look, that choice could be expensive because if they didn't have the proper coverage and they had to go through the emergency room, it would end up costing all of us more. But that's the kind of debates that we maybe should have had more of as we were leading up to the Affordable Care Act.
We will have a list of those 10 essential benefits on our website. Join that conversation in the web chat at WLRN.org. We mentioned some of those: hospitalization, emergency treatment, outpatient services. Not a lot of folks are going to argue with those necessarily, Eric, but there are some saying maternity and newborn care. Don't necessarily need it. Maybe I'm not of childbirthing years, or I'm beyond that, or I don't plan on it for various reasons. So that really is where this debate about 10 essential services may not be the umbrella kind of coverage that all health insurance recipients want or need to have.
Well, there's a lot of talk now about the fact that healthy people need to sign up for Obamacare because healthy people basically pay for people who get sick regularly. And you do have to think, all right, I don't need prenatal care, but you do contribute to that for other people.
That's right. Yep. You got to increase the pool to try to bend the cost curve. That was the original intent, obviously, of health insurance reform. Ray joins the Florida Roundup from Miami. Ray, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you, Tom. Just wanted to comment. I work for a Fortune 500 company. I reside in Miami. And for the last past 10 years, we've had Blue Cross Blue Shield. And come January 1st, we're switching over to Cigna, and we're paying $800 more a year.
$800 more per year for your coverage, so roughly about $75 more per month.
Correct. But you know we have the Blue Cross gentleman online. Just wanted to understand a little better what transpires that. Is it that Blue, for the last past 10 years, year in, year out, we've had Blue Cross, and all of a sudden we're getting changed over to Cigna. Is it because Blue Cross could not meet that quota, or?
Well, Ray, to be clear, you get insurance through your employer. Is that correct?
Correct.
And it's a Fortune 500 company, so presumably it is a large buyer of insurance. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. So Daniel, this would be considered a large group purchaser, which, as I understand the ACA, at this point in the integration of the ACA and the rollout of some of these regulations, not necessarily the large group impacted by the individual mandate or a lot of these requirements that were seen in 2014.
No, and it's important to remember that most Americans are actually not going to be affected by this requirement because they already receive their health insurance through their employer, which is, sounds like what Ray's case is. And in Ray's case, it's not really up to him what his employer offers. Many employers are changing their plans. Many of them are saying that they have to change their plans because of the Affordable Care Act. You have to really look at it individually to see. I think it's important to remember, though, Tom, that plans are not just increasing in price because they're getting better and more comprehensive. It's also costing more because of the law. And at least that's what Florida Blue and other insurers have told
the state.
What
do you mean by that?
Well, basically guaranteed issue seems to be one of the big reasons that costs are going up. Under a law that the state legislature in Florida passed last year, insurers had to file notices explaining how much their plans had increased in costs due to the Affordable Care Act. And among the biggest causes of cost increase, according to these filings, is guaranteed issue, which is basically the part that says you can't exclude people with pre-existing conditions.
Can't turn them down.
Right. You must insure everyone. I asked Florida Blue about this yesterday. And one of their actuaries, a fellow named Douglas Lynch, said that the impact of guaranteed issue and no pre-existing conditions does impact pretty much all of their members, and it represents a significant portion of the overall impact of the cost. And in many of these filings that are available through the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation, you can see, for instance, one of their bronze comparable plans would have gone up from $143 a month for a male between the ages of 21 and 29 to $256 a month. And Florida Blue says that the cost to cover everyone included in that $113 increase, 86 of those dollars was because of guaranteed issue. These are averages, and on an individual basis, that's going to vary a lot.
But that bronze coverage is the so-called catastrophic. It's the high deductible, lower level coverage.
Well, no. Catastrophic plans are separate, and they're only available to individuals who are 30 and younger. Bronze plans basically cover 60% of your costs. And you are responsible for the other 40%. They're not as comprehensive as the higher metal levels, silver, gold, and platinum.
But we're really seeing that impact of one of the regulations of the law, and that, of course, is the no turning down of a client because of pre-existing health conditions.
That's right, guaranteed issue.
Daniel Chang doing all that work with the Miami Herald. Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting also along with us. This is the Florida Roundup, and I'm Tom Hudson. Join that conversation, 800-743-WLRN. Have you ever filed a complaint against a medical professional, a doctor, a nurse? Let us know. Tweet us at WLRN online at WLRN.org, or again, the phone number, 800-743-9576. A report out this week by the Federal Florida Center for Investigative Reporting finds the state lags behind others in dealing with complaints about medical professionals. Eric Barton helped lead some of that coverage. Eric, give us an idea of what the delay is and what's the source of the delay as you understand it.
Yeah, so our reporter Steve Miller is the one who did the work on this case, I should mention. But he, what he found was that the average complaint against a medical professional in Florida took 434 days to resolve. So that's more than a year after someone has gone to them. And I should mention that if it's a serious case where there's something life-threatening, they will step in quickly, they say. But
what kind of complaints are we talking about? Are we talking about bad magazines in the reception area?
Well, for much more serious than that. So, for instance, Evan Zimmer is a former psychiatrist from Miami Beach. He was arrested and convicted of drunk driving and had a series of complaints against him that he was practicing while under influence of something. His case took more than a year to resolve. I think most people would look at that and say that seems like a case that they could have stepped in quickly.
Florida is a big state. Did you compare that response rate to, say, California or Texas or New York, other big states with a lot of big medical professionals?
Yeah, and we don't look good when you do that.
How badly do we look?
Compared to Texas, for instance, which isn't known as a state with a really active government, they took 282 days to resolve.
About half the time.
Yeah.
So what did the state have as an explanation? Is it staffing? Is it resources, financial or otherwise, or the sheer volume of complaints?
Well, that's a good question. The Department of Health won't talk about it. They wouldn't provide anybody to us to respond. You can look at a couple of things for people who do know the process, who say, first off, that the Department of Health suffered a big cutback in 2011, $55 million out of their budget. And also, they don't pay their lawyers who work on these cases very much, $52,000 it starts. And so it's pretty hard for them to keep people.
Were there different types of disciplines that had more complaints than others?
We didn't look at that. It's a really good question. And, you know, one of the things about these records is they're not easy to get. It took our reporter months to call through them. It's not something you can call up the Department of Health and say, hey, tell me about psychiatrists. So they have more complaints.
And it's part and parcel then of the difficulty in trying to solve some of those complaints. If you have bad record keeping or a really difficult kind of record keeping system, to be able to understand how this works.
That's right. You know, I think that goes back to the cutbacks, just in the fact that they don't have a lot of money going to this to try to figure out, okay, how do we fix this?
Yeah, Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, Daniel Chang covering healthcare for the Miami Herald. And Daniel, you're certainly familiar with this situation in terms of medical complaints, working on a story about a Miami doctor reprimanded and fined for dealing with some Medicaid patients. Tell us a little bit about this story and what it may highlight of the broader trend that Eric and his organization have really hit upon here.
Well, I think one of the things that you mentioned, Tom, that's important is poor record keeping that it makes it very difficult for investigators to go back and understand exactly, for instance, why doctors prescribed certain medicines or why they took certain actions or were they medically necessary. The story that I'm working on is interesting. We've written about him before. He's a Miami psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Fernando Mendez Villamil. And in 2009, United States Senator from Iowa, Republican Chuck Grassley, wrote a letter to the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time, Kathleen Sebelius, raising alarm about some healthcare providers in the Medicaid and Medicare programs mm-hmm. who were overutilizing. And Dr. Mendez-Villamil was writing something on the order of 153 prescriptions a day and costing the Medicaid and Medicare programs millions each year. He was the top prescriber in Florida. So this was in 2009. Dr. Mendez-Villamil finally had his hearing before the Florida Board of Medicine on October 4th, and he was reprimanded.
Of this year.
Of this year.
Of 2013,
yes.
4 years later.
That's correct. And I know that part of the reason that this took so long was going through his records and understanding why he was prescribing at the rate that he was prescribing. But it should seem that it would take a little less than that possibly to come to a resolution. And in the meantime, during the whole time, he was practicing and he continues to be licensed. He was suspended, I think, from the Medicaid program temporarily, mm-hmm. but from what I understand, he's back in.
There's due process, and then there's process that you have to do and get done here. We've got Daniel Chang with the Miami Herald, Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, and you can read the report from the Center for Investigative Reporting on our web chat. You can find the link there at WLRN.org. This is the Florida Roundup, and still to come on our program, a mayoral race that could only happen in Miami Beach. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Welcome back, and thanks for listening.
Let's go on with another question.
Yes, that is the sound of politics, of making an election in Miami Beach. The sound of a mayoral race. The audience riled up at a mayoral debate earlier this year in Miami Beach. Christina Vega with the Miami Herald and Michael Miller with the Miami New Times have been covering what, Christina, has got to be the best show in politics in South Florida for this election cycle, isn't it?
There's no shortage of stories to write.
So let's talk about this here, Christina, about what's at stake, first of all, before we get into some of the personalities. I believe it pays $10,000 a year. Big bucks for Miami Beach. Does not have any kind of super vote or significant veto power. So why all of the vitriolic language and positioning that we're seeing with Miami Beach? What's at stake?
You know, that's a good question. Why? A lot of people don't realize that most cities in South Florida, they don't have a strong mayor form of government, so they don't have a lot of power as mayor. But there are really big issues in Miami Beach right now. Probably the biggest is the convention center overhaul that they're planning. It's a $1 billion project right smack dab in the middle of the city. And it's become a contentious election issue. So you're kind of fighting to define the character of the city for years to come.
And Michael Miller from the Miami New Times, transportation also a big issue. But even more to the heart of Miami Beach, the governance of the city has really been questioned for a long time, but really is becoming a political issue now.
Yeah, I mean, in the last couple of years, you've had some arrests within City Hall. You've had problems with the police and fire departments. So I think a lot of people, in Miami Beach are worried about the direction of the city. This is something that Levine and Burke both have really hammered on.
Those are two of the candidates that we'll ask about here in a moment. If you live in Miami Beach, current resident, former resident, how are you looking at this mayoral campaign winding up in the first week of November? Holler at us here at WLRN and the Florida Roundup and tweet us at WLRN or the online conversation, WLRN.org. Steve Burke was one of the names you mentioned as a candidate. Give us an idea of I guess he refers to himself now as an entertainer, not a comedian.
Exactly. Yes, he's a former tennis pro, Ivy League educated. But he kind of made his name, I think, running against Matty Bauer about 3 years ago. And he, at the time, he was a comedian. He had a reality TV crew following him around at all times. Now he says they're making a documentary about him. He's very important to make that the distinction. But he is kind of the outsider candidate in a way, or at least he tries to portray himself as that. And he's, this time around, it's his second go. He's trying to be more taken more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
He's really hammered away at Bauer over the years for basically not doing enough to correct kind of the direction of the city over corruption, things like that in City Hall. And yeah, I mean, he faces kind of an uphill battle in terms of convincing people that he really is a serious candidate, especially when he, you know, keeps on putting out rap videos and things like that. But he also has some good ideas, too. So.
Well, and one of the ideas goes to transportation, Christina, and it's this gondola idea that, you know, may strike some folks as a little bit outlandish, but he seems to have some serious points here.
Yeah, so anyone who's been to the beach knows that traffic and parking is a constant headache there, and he says he's got a solution, and it's to string gondolas from downtown Miami across the bay to Miami Beach, and that this would serve not only as a fix for transportation woes, but also as a tourist attraction that would generate money. And he's gotten some interest from the CEO of Virgin Group, who says that, I don't know whether it's a full endorsement of it, but says that he would be interested in looking at it. And London recently did something like this.
Well, Richard Branson is known for outlandish ideas, commercial space travel among them, certainly. But it does bring up the idea here, Michael, of some international political personalities are paying attention to this mayoral election in a town of 80,000 people.
Right. I mean, yeah, you've got Bill Clinton weighing in, you've also got, you know, he's endorsed Philip Levine, who he says is an old friend of his. you've also got Bill Nelson. You've got Norman Brayman weighing in for Gongora, mm-hmm. who's, I guess, kind of the establishment candidate because he's been on the commission for a while. So, yeah, you do have, Miami Beach has this kind of outsized hold on the American imagination, and apparently it's, you know, drawing people in from all over the country.
Miami Beach and the mayor's seat, because again, at the end of the day, you don't have a lot of power other than to control maybe the agenda at a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment candidate, if there is one, as Michael mentioned, is Mr. Gongora. Is he running on the platform? Give us an idea of kind of the flack that he's been taking, because he is one of those in this race that has the political record that supporters and opponents can point to.
He's the only one, and yes, that brings baggage because, as we've mentioned, there's been a lot of issues, arrests at City Hall lately. His response is mainly, we're working on it. Yes, there were issues, but we're tackling them. We have new department heads, a new city manager. We're tackling rising tides and stormwater, that sort of thing. Another interesting thing to mention about Michael Gongora is that if he were elected, he would be the first openly gay mayor of Miami Beach.
But as he mentioned, he's running for mayor who happens to be gay.
Right. It really hasn't become a campaign issue, but or a platform or anything that really comes up on the campaign trail, but it's still an interesting point.
Michael Miller from the Miami New Times, you mentioned earlier some of the police behavior that's come under scrutiny as of late. And of course, most recently, this was with the Israel Hernandez case, mm-hmm. this 18-year-old graffiti artist who was tasered by Miami police fatally. Has this been an issue?
You know, not really. His name doesn't come up very much in the campaign at all. As far as I can tell, the only person who really made any statement was Steve Burke, who made, you know, issued some condolences on his Facebook account, I think. But part of the problem there is that, Suarez in the Miami mayor race, he put out a flyer which had Israel Hernandez's face on it and expressed, you know, sympathy. And he took a lot of flack immediately from the Miami
Commissioner
police.
Suarez yeah. did, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He wound up dropping out of the Miami mayoral race.
Exactly, and you know, I don't think that was the deciding factor there, but it certainly backfired on him and drew a lot of unwanted attention to it. So I think ever since that happened, candidates in Miami Beach have been a little reticent to make it an issue. But certainly police, you know, problems within the police department is a big issue. And, you know, it's interesting looking down at some of the other races. You've got, you know, Bauer also running for commission, Exposito, Gongora, all three of them voted for Martinez, the police chief.
So, in Miami Beach.
That might be something that could come back to, haunt them.
Christina Vega from the Miami Herald, the moneyed candidate here, Philip Levine, millions of dollars pouring into this, again, for a position that it certainly does not have any direct economic interest, does not have any specific political power. What's the source of his candidacy? Is it solely his fortune?
He is mostly self-funding his campaign. He's poured over more than $1 million of his own money into it. He caps campaign contributions. I think it's at $100. He hosts events that he calls friend raisers instead of fundraisers, and he picks up the tab at the end of the meal or whatever it is. He says that basically he's running because he wants to make the city better, and that, you know, it has been something that he's been attacked for because he does have businesses and he is partners with a developer on Miami Beach. And so Burke especially has questioned, you know, if you get in, how are we going to stop basically your agenda and your friends from getting what they want out of the city? So
you two have a front row seat to the best show in politics this fall. Yes, enjoy it while it lasts, right? In a relatively quiet election season, Miami Beach there was not disappointing anyone for those paying attention. And certainly two of them are with us here on the Florida Roundup. Christina Vega writing about it in the Miami Herald, Michael Miller writing about it in Miami New Times. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. For almost 20 years, Cuba has had two currencies, one pegged to the U.S. dollar used by tourists and international trade, the other used to pay Cuban salaries and other products. Tim Padgett is the WLRN America's correspondent. Some surprising news this week, Tim, in regards to this two-currency system, and apparently it's going to be ending.
Well, yeah, Cuban dictator Raul Castro announced this week that he wants to do away with this two-tier currency system. On the one hand, the dollar-denominated, what they call the convertible peso, which, as you described, is, you know, the higher-end coin, and then the what they call the Cuban peso, the regular Cuban peso, that's worth 25 times less than the convertible peso. And he wants to end that two-tiered system, somehow integrate the two currencies into one Cuban currency, and hopefully he thinks, and he hopes anyways, that will enhance his free market economic reforms.
Yeah, Cuba not known for a sophisticated foreign exchange market. Can it pull it off?
Well, no, yeah, neither of those coins is worth a diddly squat, you know, outside of Cuba. But if what he has to pull off is making sure that the new peso that's created will not only be, you know, worth something, but accessible to the small businesses, right, that he needs to proliferate on Cuba so that his economic reforms work.
Is this a natural extension of some of those economic reforms that began just a few years ago in terms of trying to free up some of the small businesses there?
Sure. I mean, I've talked with small entrepreneurs in Cuba often on the phone, and the one biggest headache they always talk about is not having access to dollars or to the convertible peso, because as you know all too well, if you're a small entrepreneur, you need that access to hard currency to buy wholesale imported goods to make your business run.
And that's it. I mean, the dollar is called the reserve currency of the world. The Chinese use it. The Canadians use it. The Russians use it. The European Union uses it. Latin America uses it. But for Cuban small businesses to try to do international trade without access to that U.S. dollar, even if it's a Cuban currency that's pegged, shuts them out of the world economy.
But the big question is here, even if he does create a more effective peso or currency, will it really mean anything if they don't also take other measures like opening up big time enterprises like sugar to more private investment, right, more productivity on the island, etc.? There are so many other things that Cuba has to do. This is just one component.
And rate at this point the ability and the speed and the relative success that's necessary for this to happen.
Well, as one analyst here told me, this is not something that's going to happen in 2 weeks. And then he said, I don't even know if they can make it work in 2 years.
I think it took the European Union about a decade to introduce the euro.
Exactly. And if it took the European Union that long, you're talking about molasses, in terms of Cuba.
Tim Padgett covers Latin America for us here at WLRN as our America's correspondent. Thank you, Tim. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We will have a rebroadcast of this program tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., right here on WLRN. It'll also be up on the website at WLRN.org. Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer at the station is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Mr. Paul Leary. Thank you, sir. South Florida Arts Beat is next, the second annual Miami Nice Jazz Festival, and the Florida Grand Opera CEO. Only you're going to hear that on South Florida Arts Beat here on WLRN. Next Monday morning on the Sunshine Economy at 9 a.m., it is the grocery business here in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. We'll take you out with some Cuban music about trying to get U.S. dollars into the island nation from family members. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.